Senator Fryer, how do you feel about this?
Well, I suppose to some extent we're overlooking the policy question that goes into this whole separate classification. That is, why are policemen and firemen treated differently from other public employees? Every time you add to the category, I think it should be justified on some policy basis. It sounds to me from that amendment as if the county could simply say, well, okay, you're the civil process server, but we're going to call you a policeman. I don't know whether they'd do that or not, but I mean, they could, I guess, and that would make that person a policeman by definition, whether that person was really in the same kind of a classification as these other folks. And I don't know whether the legislature wants to do that.
Okay, I'd like Bob to comment on that. How would that, with them calling them police officers, what other rights does it give them, if any?
Madam Chairman, it would not give them any, I would think it would not give them any status as a police officer other than as a police officer for purposes of the retirement system. Now, they might feel it would do so, but other aspects of being a police officer are, say, the arrest, carrying firearms, things like those. Those are dealt with in other statutes. And I would think, in this instance, the characterization of a civil deputy as a police officer by the county governing body would be only for the purposes of PERS.
And it would be just as easy for the county to classify the staff of the planning department as police officers. I mean, they would accomplish that result. And so you get down to, I guess, to the issue that I'm not clear about or I'm pondering, and that is, who are the people that really should be entitled to whatever benefits policemen and firemen get? And there was some testimony, of course, that the civil deputies, at least in Multnomah County, face from time to time some harrowing circumstances, I guess, but whether that's sufficient to really put them in the same category as police officers, I'm not prepared to say. Now, I have a further question, and that is, surely the civil deputies in Multnomah County are members of some bargaining group, aren't they?
Yes.
And
Chambler Gillespie was here.
Okay. Is it possible that even if they're not classified as police officers, is it possible that couldn't be negotiated then with the county government?
Well, that's the problem that Mr. Lundy brings up with, if they're not hired by the sheriff's office, the sheriff doesn't have the power to
decree
them.
That.
And nor does the county, according to the statute, or does it, Bob?
Madam Chair, no, it does not. No. The way I read it, there would be no category in the present statute under which a civil deputy not in the sheriff's office could be designated a police officer for retirement purposes.
You would agree with that.
And so, in other words, the civil deputy and the civil deputy's bargaining unit couldn't sit down with the county and say, we want you to write a definition of the job we do, and it would be just what she got through saying, and that wouldn't be enough to get them into the special category. Is that right, or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Frye, I suppose they could collectively bargain, and the first issue would be, shall the civil deputies be put in the sheriff's office?
Well, of course.
And then the second step, now that they're in the sheriff's office, shall the sheriff designate them as police officers? With that two-step approach, I suppose collective bargaining could be used to get them in.
Well, do we have enough time for Mr. I don't care who does it, but somebody to tell me, I think I can guess, but I want to be accurate on this. Why is it that we are taking firemen and policemen and putting them in this category for earlier retirement? Now, my guess is that because their life expectancy isn't as great as other people, and they lead a hazardous life, and they really shouldn't be around after they're a certain age, and that kind of thing. Is that it?
Historical center, right. Yeah.
And has there been anything developed since the beginning of this that would indicate that maybe there's some other reasons why we should have early retirement benefits for these Rutherford.
Well, yes, sir. They've, Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, they've testified in many areas, many benefit bills regarding disability, regarding health coverage, and so forth, of various stresses and resulting physical disabilities or physical conditions that would tend you tend to believe that early retirement should be granted, etc. It also has been historical that they've been very jealous, and probably rightfully so, as the board has in protecting that category from misuse, misuse in the sense of not covering those individuals who, in truth, are not presented with those hazards and stresses.
Right,
so there are some fine lines and some gray lines. I'm sure they've been crossed over from time to time. At this point in time, I know the board has felt that from existing legislation, you can see that they have felt in the past and still feel that the civil deputy situation is not as acute, at least in their minds, as the civil deputies feel.
Now, I know that the probation officers have been added, correctional officers have been added since the beginning, but it's true from the way I understand it from what you just got through saying that even though other types of work have been added to the law, the theory behind that has remained the same throughout, and that is the hazardous nature of the duty. That's pretty much it. That hasn't changed.
I could concur with that, yes.
Don't come with anything. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I guess I'm about to move on to
yes.
The other section of the bill. Do we have anything else?
On page 13, in the provisions which I also copied and everyone has a copy in their file, coverage for police officers and firefighters, we conformed the definitions to the definitions that we just talked about.
So there is no further amendment to that, right? Or are you amending, further amending?
Well, the proposal is to insert in 237.610 after ORS 181.610 parentheses 2 to insert parole and probation officers as defined in ORS 181.610.5, and then employees of a county who are authorized to serve and execute civil process.
No, we left that by.
Well, this is just the proposal. Are you?
No, we've passed that proposal ago.
But this is another provision. I'm going to just say that we've...
Yeah, where are we at?
On page 13. After line 23, there are separate provisions for coverage for police officers and firefighters, which also has definition section.
Yes. Okay.
Now, this is just a proposal which parallels what we were talking about.
Okay, but we have finished talking about. We are not amending anything. So do
except
we then?
That we need to add parole and probation officers as defined in
right.
ORS 181.610.5.
Right.
Because that we're leaving as it was in the...
Correct.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if I may interject, at a point in time when specific benefits were increased and redefinitions were made of police and fire, Section 610 was added to our act, not added to our membership definition section up front. Hmm. And this, if you do anything with civil deputies, which you plan not to do, you would have to do it here. So you're not doing anything, you don't mention civil deputies, but since we're doing something with parole and probation officers under 610.5, and that first sentence, parole and probation officers as defined in ORS 610.5, should be inserted in this section.
Right.
Okay, so we will just stop at that.
Right.
All right. Then in Section 9, there are several changes that are proposed to conform the bill.
In new Section 9.
Section 9.
I'm looking for the wrong thing. Section 9.
Right. Yeah, I lost my study.
Go to the last page.
The last page of what, the bill now?
The bill.
That's what we were looking at. That's
okay, at the end of the bill, we're going to insert a section which will contain the TRFA conforming amendments.
Oh.
And to explain that, we have Tom Kramer from TRFA, who's worked with Bob Lundy on those. Okay?
Bob, if you'd like to come up, just to clarify quickly what your Section 9 includes.
Don.
Tom Kramer, excuse me.
That's fine. Madam Chairperson, Bob and I worked on it together, and most of the good work has been his. Chairperson Cohen, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Tom Kramer. My address is 900 Southwest 5th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. I represent the Teachers Retirement Fund Association, or TRFA. The proposed conforming amendment, as all the other conforming amendments you've seen, is designed to ensure that the parallel treatment of TRFA, the Teachers Retirement System, and PERS is maintained as required in ORS 239.203. TRFA Board of Trustees supports this bill in general, although it will have some effects on the Teachers Retirement System which are different from the effects on PERS. The Board of Trustees would like to bring at least some of those points to your attention. I could walk through the whole bill or just the definitional section if you prefer to stop with that.
Well, I think you've had lots of chance to testify on the whole bill. This is the third time up. But I guess, so I'd like to have your explanation of the your amendment sections.
Okay. That would be fine, Madam Chair. That would be fine. Thanks, Bob.
Now, I'm assuming that you're doing this in the whole context of the amendments that you're proposing.
That's right.
To conform, and that the other notions of what you have are not necessarily amendments but comments on the bill. Do they involve the explanation of amendments that you're offering to other parts of the bill?
If I understand your question, Madam Chair, the comments relate to, well, thinking specifically of the definitional sections, they relate to the effect of the conforming amendment changes adopting the bill's language on Chapter 239, the Teachers Retirement System.
Okay, I assume that your conforming amendments are going to take care of that and include at the points that you wish the term TRFA, if you will, or the definitions that you have that might be different.
Essentially, that's correct. That's correct, I think. All the conforming amendment does is adopt the bill's terms to the extent applicable, as Bob and I have determined it, to the Teachers Retirement System. The comments are designed to flag the extent to which those changes will have substantive rather than procedural or purely housekeeping effects on the Teachers Retirement System. The bill is described as a housekeeping bill for PERS. It's somewhat more than that for us, and that's to be expected.
Are you asking us to start over on this bill now?
Absolutely not, Madam Chair. I think these are minor problems which can be taken care of in drafting or in minor wording or phrase changes.
It's a mystery to me. Indeed. Well, why don't you go through then, and I guess I don't know how to deal with this otherwise. We will look at the amendments that come to us in writing. I suggest that you write the concerns you have with Senate Bill 137, submit them to the committee members, and we will have a chance to read that over, and if there are areas that compromise language can be drawn, fine, or I guess that at that point the committee will have to go once again through the bill and make the decision about whether we want to go forward with 137 in the section. So I guess I'm rather than take yet another 40 minutes on a bill that we've already taken many hours on and many hours of staff time, and now kind of at the last minute we're about to send this out to find out that there are problems yet with other parts of the bill, it would be helpful to have known as we went along. But my suggestion then is to get all of the amendments in writing, and that we have a chance to look them over, and that we will have one more final session on this bill with a minimal amount of discussion, and we will go up or down on it. So thank you very much.
That would be fine, Madam Chair. The amendments that you have at present accomplish the goal of transferring the bill or ensuring the applicability of the bill to the teacher's retirement system. If the committee,
yeah, that's what our intent was with what I understood were conforming amendments, and that's what we were going to try to do. And then, so we'll try to see what other problems there are with it with respect to the TRFA system, if in fact 137 does or doesn't have problems with it. Any other comments on the committee?
Yes, not on this witness, but I have another question.
Yes.
I just want to know why the emergency clause is on this bill.
I don't have the slightest idea, and I'm not sure that it needs to be. Jim, do you have a question? You know why the emergency clause was on? I would think that at one point in time, the Nancy Riles amendments, there were people who thought they needed some resolution of that problem. We've already sent that along the way. If you have a reason for the emergency clause, Jim, I think you need to share that with us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, a couple of things, I suppose. If it isn't broke, don't fix it. And if it needs fixing, fix it as soon as you can. Other than that, we had hoped that these were clear enough and in need that we could just implement them as quickly as possible. And that would be our best reason for asking for the emergency clause. A couple of the items, as Jerry brings to my attention, involving the situation of probate and non-probate, where we have legal actions pending, or could be pending, that again, just as quickly as we can be able to determine the new applications, the better off we would be for membership.
Okay, I understand now that the probate part and some of those other areas we haven't spent much time on, but we'll look into that, and I'll ask staff and Senator Fry to check to see whether the probate is of that nature of a pressing need. Thank you very much. Are there other questions?
Is there something pending right now in the courts, or just something they're worried about?
I don't know. They're not. Jared, yes. Is there something that's pending?
Madam Chairman, we ran into a problem over the years when people became members of the system and then took a refund of their money. When they reestablished membership at some time later on, we did not have them complete a new designation of beneficiary. And therefore, if that individual died, we went ahead and we paid the prior designated beneficiary. They took us to court and we lost the case. The judge said that when you take a refund of your money, it also wipes out your beneficiary. This one will say that it keeps it back in, so we will not run into those problems.
So it's something that could happen, but it's not happening right now.
It happens to us about once a month, and with account balances getting up to the $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, it would be nice if we could take care of it as soon as possible. I think that is one of the reasons that it is in here, that because of what the judge ruled.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senate Bill 136, Ray Barnwell.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Ray Barnwell. I'm with the Oregon Fire Police Retirement Committee. My residence is at 415 West Oak Street in Jacksonville. The Fire Police Retirement Committee is in full agreement with the Senate Bill 136. We are offering some amendments due to the fact that we think it's a very good idea, but with the fiscal impact that Mr. McGoffin has told me that is in this bill, we felt that if something wasn't done, it would end up going through the shredder. So we understand that the state and the local entities and the school districts and everyone else are having a fiscal problem. So in our amendments, which are being passed out right now to Senate Bill 136, what we are entertaining doing is changing the intent of the bill, which would require the employer to allow the retired member to stay under the present health insurance plan that they would now be under and that way they would receive the benefit of a group rate and pay the 100% of the premium themselves. Now we have it in the in this amendment too that if under a collective bargaining agreement the it was negotiated that the employer would pay a portion or half or a quarter or all, whatever, that would be acceptable. But from the start, the retired member would pay 100% of the premium themselves, and therefore the only fiscal impact that you would see would be whatever the difference in the experience rate of the group insurance carrier would be for that certain entity. And I'm not sure if possibly Mr. McGoffin could enlighten us on this, but I'm not sure if it would be enough of an impact where we could even be able to gauge what it is. Now, I found out that amending the bill to do it this way were not affecting a whole lot of public employees. My understanding is that the state employees can already do the same thing. They're allowed to either stay under their health insurance that is either provided by the state or by the public employees union, or if it's their option, they can go under the PERS plan. There's many school districts. In fact, I understand that most of the large school districts already allow their employees to stay under the group health coverage. The same way with the cities and special districts. So what we're talking about under this is to take on the people that are not allowed at the present time to have this advantage on retirement. And so everyone under the system that's retiring receives the same opportunity under a coverage under a health care plan. Now this amendment also, which differs from 136, covers not only agencies that are under the public employees retirement system, but we do have some agencies that are under a private carrier, and it would cover them too. You're probably aware of the public safety section of the Equal to a Better plan, and if any police or fire agencies were under a plan other than the PERS, they would still be covered under this section of the law. Same way with schools or any other public agency.
Ray, how long this would continue as long as you are on, you're getting the retirement benefits then?
Well, I just would probably, I imagine, be under the, as far as the retired person is concerned, but generally when they reach the age where they're covered under the Social Security and Medicare and this, that, and the other thing, usually they tend to drop off their health insurance, although we don't know just what's happening there either.
Okay, but I'm saying the bill would allow you to continue as long as you want to pay.
Yes.
The bill itself. Well, I'm not asking for necessarily what happens out there. I'm just saying that you...
The amendment? Yes.
Yes, with the amendment, it would allow you to come in, pay either full or partial, and continue to pay that as long as you were either living or cared to.
Mm-hmm.
As far as you understand.
That's the way I have the amendment written, yes, ma'am. Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chairperson.
Senator Poy.
Is that at the same group rate?
Yes. At the same group rate of from the group that you retired from.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Fry.
And it may be then that from year to year, however often these carriers look at their rates, that could change because there's now a different age group in there. Is that what you suggested? It's kind of hard to measure that.
Don't know how they would actually make a projection at it, to be quite honest. But it's happening in the larger agencies right now, and evidently it's not putting them in a real big fiscal bind. But that's what would happen. Yeah, they would have to go in. You can't say how sick a retired person is going to get, or if they are.
So it'd just be another factor that's built into the experience factor, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Another aspect of the experience factor that would influence the premium rate down the road. Kind of hard to guess what that might be.
Now, Mr. McGoffin could enlighten you on this here, but under the policy that is provided to the retired people from PERS, their experience rate, I imagine, is quite a bit different because it entails only retired people. And if I understand right, they can't even find an agency that'll bid for better rates. And so allowing the retired person to stay under their present group plan would make a lot of difference in their premiums.
Okay. Could we have Jim McGoffin up again to talk about, Tim, you stay, Ray, if you have other, we have other questions. I want to ask, understand more carefully exactly how PERS currently works, people who want to. Just a little bit on how it works now, and then we can go ahead with Ray's questions that we might have for him.
Jim McGoffin, director of PERS, and Jerry Liebers, my assistant director, who quite incidentally, but very factually, does handle the insurance side of the program. So we're very fortunate to have him with you today. The program is described by Ray, the amendments are described by Mr. Barnwell, would in effect remove this a bill as a retirement bill in a very true sense. And in creating that opportunity for the individuals to remain covered with their employer, in this instance, as the amendments are drafted forever, ad infinitum, would be an approach. Their experience then would be with their employer and not with any other group plan, and it would obviously be subsidized as members of that group. And Jerry can explain to you the two programs that we have for the retiree policies now. They are CNA policies and available under 65 and the Medicare sub after 65. Sure.
Madam Chairman, basically on the state employees are the ones that we have coverage for outside of our regular CNA PERS program. In our own program, there are probably about 9,500 retirees enrolled. The vast majority of them are in a Medicare supplement plan. What they have done is these people, primarily school, city, county employees, have left their employment, and for one reason or the other, the county, the city, did not allow them to continue their coverage, and therefore they were out in the cold until such time as they got to be 65, and they came under our program. Excuse me. Or at the time they retired, any member of the public employees retirement system can come under the PERS program, provided they do so within 90 days from the time they retire. Now, the problems that they come up with is, as a state employee today of 32 years, if I retired on disability tomorrow, I would lose my coverage, basically. They would keep me for a year, but the companies do not keep people who are disabled. And I think this is a group of people that should be looked at. What would happen, in my estimation, and I've talked to many brokers and carriers on this, is it true that our program, because of the type of group of people that basically are elderly, the cost factor is high. It's only a 70% reimbursement instead of the normal 80%. But if this program as presented was put into effect, it would take that and move that all among all of the employers in the state. There are about 1,100 of them out there. And as these employers have their program, they may have to continue the program for one retired individual. There's no question it would be a cost to that particular program, but at the same time, the cost would not be, I don't think, that monumental. I think the other thing is, you know, I look at the moral side of it, and one of these people is, is this what we should do? Should we cover them if they go out on disability, or do we cover them for all of the years when they're in good health, and then not take it out.
Mention the approximate subsidization.
Yeah. The CNA program, PERS, we have had with CNA for about 22 years now, and it is true because of the nature of the group of plan that we cannot get any other company to bid except CNA. We put it out each year to about 24 companies, Blue Cross, NHA, you name it. We put it out to everyone, and everyone does not want to bid on the program because of the makeup of the group that is in it. In the state program, I'm sure you recognize, we as active employees subsidize the retired people. We pay a subsidy each month, each and every state employee, and that is how you keep the state's rate down. Otherwise, the state rate for instance, for Blue Cross people when they were retired would be ballooned right out on them. We can do that, and I think what Ray and his program is saying, we should do that among all employers. All employers, the younger people, should subsidize the older people until they get there. I think one of the important things that
program design that covers a lot of cost. I would assume that a part of what would happen if the retirees were in their own group, that there would be some tinkering with the design. You mentioned 70% of costs being paid by the insurance program under PERS. Well, we're paying anywhere from 100% to 80% depending on which coverages we're talking about. So a number of things would happen if they were separated. I can assure you that they would come out either spending a lot more money or getting less coverage than they're now getting. And that's the dilemma on what to do with that.
So their costs would be, if they were going to go, if they're even part of the group and say we're going to split them out so they pay their share of the group, it would be 220, you say 240, something like that?
Probably,
more.
Yes. At one time, we suggested keeping the retirees within the active groups, but splitting out their experience, having them pay whatever it is that their cost was. But we'd be looking at the same kind of numbers no matter what we did in that regard. Mm-hmm. It would reduce the active employee premium by about 4 or 5%, and it would drastically increase the group of retirees who are under our programs. That's really the issue. How do I get benefits as a retiree without
people really
bankrupt?
Knew that they wouldn't retire at 55 anymore, would they?
Perhaps not. I don't
know. Or 58, maybe.
Yeah, this program doesn't affect anybody over 65, I think.
No, only as a supplement at that point.
Let me ask you if there are any. Senator Timson, did you have a question? Okay, Senator McCoy.
Oh, I just want to talk about the politicians. Who has your coverage
to take care of you from the cradle to the grave? Madam Chair, Senator, our statewide carrier is Blue Cross.
Blue Cross.
And we have the full complement of HMOs strung around the state as well, as the other board does. The statewide carrier for your information for BUG, remember now there's two benefit boards, is CNA.
Oh, CNA has BUG. That's
right.
Senator
right.
Simmons.
Madam Chair, you said that above 65, it's a supplement to Medicare.
That's,
is that possible now with the new regulation that Medicare is the supplement?
Madam Chair, Senator, if an employee is still an active employee yet past that 65 years old, the primary carrier is the carrier. If they are retired, the primary is Medicare Medicaid, with the other carrier being the supplement.
And your program does carry a supplement then?
Yes.
For all retirees?
Yes.
After 65.
And I should note, because it came up before, but there seemed to be some confusion, people who are retired from state service carry the insurance program at their own cost presently. Now, the reason they wish to do that is because they're within this total group from young to older. And they're getting the benefit of that group rate and that total experience as opposed to their own isolated experience.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I might, as my final note, suggest that executive department certainly would be in agreement with the amendments that we heard today, because our major concern here is that $17 million price tag.
Yeah. That's been taken care of by Section
7. Well, it has been taken care of, but the premium increase has not been addressed in terms of spreading that, so we need to get some interest. Some. We may have to.
There is the statement.
So, Senator Simmons has a question, and then we need to move on because we have a senator.
The only remark that I don't think that the who pays the cost is taken care of by the amendment, because it says that there will be a collective bargaining agreement as to who is to pay for it. And my observation is that collective bargaining sometimes has more power on the employee's part than it does on the state's part.
Madam Chair, may I speak to that?
Yes, please.
I'm not the administrator of the Labor Division, but since we work very closely together, I would comment to you that that's possible now, and my guess is that clause was put in there just to protect that particular process. If the OPU, as an example, wanted to put in their collective bargaining agreements that there would be a contribution towards their retirees, I suggest that that's a bargainable item for them now. So I'm not sure the significance of that particular portion.
Now, Madam Chairman,
Senator McCoy,
just so that when we come back next time, we'll be talking about the same thing, I'd like to move the amendments, SB 136-1, so that we can talk about this bill instead of the other.
Are there objections to that? I don't think there's anybody who wants to talk to the original bill at this point in time. So I would, so ordered, we will accept the amendments and we will hear. Thank you both for coming, and thank you, Don. Good luck.
Thank you.
We'll work with, see if we can gather a little more information to see what we choose to do. Obviously, it'll be a contact to Blue Cross and a few of the other people to see what kind of impact we might have on the system. Thank you very much. We have Senator Day, who is here on SJR 8.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is L.B. Day. I am a state senator from District 16. I appear here in support of SJR 8. Very basically, as you know, the Common School Fund something a long-term investment. We operate off the interest from that. And I would believe that using those funds and investing in Oregon is something that I think is of importance, and that's the purpose of it, and I would urge your support from the committee. Currently, we have an Attorney General's opinion that says we can't do this. That's why this resolution is here, and that's why I'm asking you to go to the voters to allow us and actually direct that we invest funds from the Common School Fund in Oregon business and investment.
Madam Chairman?
Senator Frye.
Is there a statute implementing Section 2 of Article 8 right now?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, no. And I think basically if indeed the committee should take action and what have you, then the people approve it, then I would leave it to the next session of the legislature to implement the approach. But I believe that, you know, looking at several other funds we have, I think there are some impediments to that. But the Common School Fund, I do not consider this as a trust fund such as the retirement funds we have for state employees. And I think that very basically, I think directly investing that in Oregon makes a lot of sense to me. It's long-term funds. It's principal. We actually operate off the interest. And I'm not suggesting we go afoul of the prudent man rule.
What I'm asking about. You're still
but at least, yes, at least I think that it ought to be done here and restricted this within the confines of the prudent man rule.
And do you still have in mind that the State Investment Council would be restricted?
Absolutely. No question. I really don't want to circumvent anything other than to say, in this particular circumstances, within the prudent man rule, I want you to invest in Oregon.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Simmons.
LB, how about may be invested in Oregon rather than shall be? Restricted to if there aren't prudent investments in Oregon at the time, there may be money that cannot be invested at all.
That's a pleasant law, though, isn't it?
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, that's the way it is.
No, it just says it shall be invested.
Yeah.
As the legislative.
No, I mean, what I'm trying to say is under current law, we're prohibited from directing them. It is maybe now. I mean, they could right now invest it. In fact, the current state treasurer, I criticized him 2 years ago for failure to really take in account Oregon firms and investments, and he dazzled me with the amount of effort that he'd made in the last 4 years of actually investing in Oregon. So to suggest that we haven't been investing in Oregon from a lot of funds is just it's not simply the case. We have. But I think in this particular case, I think a lot of people, I think they'd feel somewhat secure the fact that we could find investments within the prudent man rule. Your suggestion is if they couldn't, it could mean those funds would lie fallow. I guess I don't see a circumstances where there wouldn't be investments within the prudent man rule in Oregon. I just think we're diversified enough that that would not be a consequence. And, you know, if that's the committee was wisdom, I don't think we change a heck of a lot. If you change that, then there's no point in sending the resolution, in my opinion.
Well,
excuse me, could you repeat that again?
I think that if you were to change it to May, as Senator Simmons suggests, I think they can do that now. My point is, I think they can improve. What we're saying is that we're directing them, at least where this fund's concerned, to invest in Oregon, period.
Okay, and you're still asking them to stay within the prudent person fund?
Yeah, I still want the investment council.
Okay. How much money are you talking about? Senator Fry, no, go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that if this gets implemented, it's going to be very interesting to see what can be done with Oregon investments.
That's exactly right. And I know Senator Cohen was going to ask me how much, and I hurried down here. I had a file, and I'm not sure just what the total fund is involved, but I'll be glad to get the information to the committee. I just got back there.
We need to know how much.
I will furnish that information. I have that.
And how much is or isn't that, right. And where it's invested.
I will be glad to furnish that.
The return now would be interesting, Madam Chairperson.
Pardon?
The return, which has something to do with the prudent.
Sure, I can get that information, and I have it, and I apologize for not bringing it.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Jernstad.
Does that mean now be that they'd be directed to divest themselves of any investments?
No, I don't intend them to divest themselves of. My intention on this, if you think so, I'd want to make that clear in the resolution. What I'm intending is that future investments be earmarked for Oregon, and I would like, as Senator Fry has pointed out, I think it'd be interesting what they could do with a portfolio in Oregon, and I think by using this particular fund, we don't jeopardize anyone's retirement, what have you. I don't think we're jeopardizing anything to start with, but I think it'd give us an opportunity to focus in just what can be done with a portfolio for Oregon business. Okay?
Does anyone else have questions? Thank you.
All right, could I ask?
Are you here to talk about another one?
Yes, if I could.
I'd like to do that and then get
it. Sure,
answered.
That would help.
Senator McCoy, you had a question.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Okay.
No, I don't have one.
You may. He's going to.
No, I'll talk to him first.
All right.
Okay.
If you have some private funds you want to invest, I'll talk to you.
Okay.
We can also get so lucky. I'd like, if I can, Madam Chairman, I appreciate very much the courtesy. I'd like to appear here in support of Senate Bill 314. The major reason that I do is I've had constituent friends who have worked very actively in the Oregon State Employees Organization and then retired. And the purpose of support here is to allow that people who may be retired could serve, hopefully, on the retirement board so that there would be some input from retired employees as well as those who are active. And the purpose of doing this is to expand it for that purpose. So that's a major reason my interest in the bill, and I just lend my support to it. Mr. Thompson and others who support this legislation are here, and they'll go into it in greater detail. But I would support that notion. I think it's important that they have representation.
Okay. Senator Fry.
Senator, you prefer the form of Senate Bill 314 over Senate Bill 527, which has some slight differences.
I guess I'm not interested. Do I care about numbers? My purpose is that a person who is retired and part of the system have where they could be represented on the board.
Yeah, well, this bill provides that five members either must be employees or retired employees, and the other bill it just requires seven. Two members to be.
I guess
they ought to be increased.
I think there ought to be increased, and I think there ought to be retired members available. And as I understand it now, it isn't necessarily so a retired member could serve on the board. At least that's the information I have. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Madam Chairperson, I have a
Senator Tim. Has a question. Okay.
It relates to 527. You're not testifying for, and see your name's on Senate Bill 527. Okay.
I just mean I'm opposed to it. I'm not hung up on numbers, as I told you.
Somebody else?
Let's see here.
Six.
I want to finish. Bill Thompson is. Are you here, Bill? You want to come and say something about Senate Bill 314? So we can take up. We'll go back to SJR 8. As soon as we get.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
For the record, I am W.M. Thompson. I live at 1311 Warren Street. Here in Salem. I'm a retired auditor from the Department of Revenue. With the Chair's permission, I would like to support this bill and offer an amendment in the form of the letter that I wrote some time ago to Senator Cohen. Before the end of 1982, various chapters of the retired Oregon State employees became concerned about the impending loss from the retirement board of Bill Holtzclaw due to retirement. Because of his knowledge and caring service, I was asked to write to Governor Tia about what we perceived to be a solution to this impending loss. I'll quote this small part of that letter. Retired Oregon State employees and other employee retirement groups of the United Seniors would ask a very special favor of you that even though you recognize Mr. Holtzclaw's termination for full-time active employment with the Forestry Department, you do not immediately appoint a replacement to the Public Employees Retirement Board. This would allow Mr. Holtzclaw to continue to serve, at least temporarily. This would give an opportunity for what we would consider remedial legislation to be presented and acted affirmatively on by the legislature. Specifically, we plan to submit a bill to change ORS 237255 from, quote, three members shall be employees to, quote, three members shall be active or retired employees. Governor Tia could not, within the law, accede to our request. The retired community, however, still felt a need for corrective legislation, hence Senate Bill 314 to provide for retirees from the public sector to serve on the retirement board. There are currently about 42,000 retirement checks sent out monthly, about 170 participants in the fund. When one-fourth of the participants are retirees, there should be specific board membership from their ranks. There is a retired member, Judge Landry, but he is not a PERS retiree. He's a retiree under the Judge's Retirement Fund. In putting Senate Bill 314 together, we also added a provision for enlargement of the retirement board. We do not currently believe that this provision is wise or necessary. We therefore suggest that at today's meeting, the committee accept and act upon an amendment of line 6, page 1, to reinsert the deleted 5 and drop the proposed word 7. The retirement board then would remain at its presently constituted membership level. We feel, as many others do, that the present board size is at its most workable and effective size. We would add another thing that was pointed out to the governor is that an active employee serving on the board going into retirement and experiencing firsthand some of the problems and some of the glitches that happen to retirees could be of exceptional benefit to the board. They do not have the advantage of that at the present. We trust that this bill in this amended form will be looked upon favorably by your committee and passed as amended.
Thank
I will
you very
answer
much
any questions
for
that
your,
you might
for
have.
Your, now, I think it's clear to the members what he's suggesting as an amendment is that we go back to the existing membership, but we change the statute to allow someone who's
simply
to
change
come, to
inserting
in.
The word active or
right.
retired.
Good.
That could be one
yeah.
or more than one.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
We feel that it, since appointment of committees is the governor's responsibility or duty, it should be left to him, whoever he may be or she may be, to live with that responsibility. We don't think that special groups should be saying, hey, you got to put this person on or you got to put that person on.
No.
We look for experience rather than name tags.
Thank you. Senator McCoy.
Okay, we'll have a work session on this.
Yes, we will have a work session. We've got a lot of people signed up and we've got people coming. Are there other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Let's go back to SJR 8 while we have it fresh in our mind. We have Fred Hansen who's come to talk to us. I asked Fred to come up and talk about the investments of the amount of common school fund that is currently being invested and if you know how that might be done. Thank you. How that might be currently done.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Fred Hansen, Deputy State Treasurer. I was in and out of other meetings, so I didn't hear all the testimony before. What I'd like to do is just to answer any questions, unless you'd like to have me specifically address something right now.
Madam Chairperson? Yes.
Senator McCoy.
You presently administer this fund.
We are the investment officer, Senator McCoy, for this as all other funds
right.
under state control.
Do you feel this a good idea?
First off, I need to confess some question about whether or not the intent of the resolution is to have all future investments made in Oregon, or whether that is only to specifically provide that those future investments may be made in Oregon. Is this an also language or a sole language? And
all.
I'm not clear on which
all.
It is all.
Senator Frye says all.
He said all.
Over time, such language will in fact ensure that with our average life on the portfolio of about 9.9 years, it means in 9.9 years all investments will be made in Oregon because of just the maturing of existing investments. I think the first question that needs to be looked at is can one prudently invest the $116 million solely within one geographical area? If you were looking at it just from the fiduciary responsibility of that one fund, you want geographical distribution as well as type of security distribution which is really an issue of diversification. I think that would raise a first question. Second question is it's probably the imponderable one, and that is the Constitution now, and as it would be amended, provides that the Legislative Assembly shall by law provide the terms on how those investments are to be handled in the future. If that law, combined with this Senate Joint Resolution, would result in below market yield or some other fashion that would result in substandard investments, then it would be possibly, I checked this with the Attorney General's office, it would raise questions about whether or not this approach would be in conflict with the Admissions Act, which says that the Common School Fund, constitutional funds, shall be dedicated to the sole purpose of educating in our public schools. And the question then is whether this applies a standard which is seeking other goals than that which is included in the Admission Act. And again, I will quote the Attorney General's office just to say that it raises questions, but that it's tied principally to what actually happens in the legislation that would seek to implement this new language.
Then, Madam Chairperson, then what I gather from what you're seeing is that perhaps it would not be prudent to invest all funds because of the necessity for diversification and whatever that you would have to have in a prudent investment.
One, Madam Chair, Senator McCoy, yes, our concern is with any one fund that one is looking at, there should be diversity relative to geography as well as type of securities. We have, because we have a number of major funds under our authority for investment, we already have fairly major investments within Oregon, principally because of the size of the funds out of the PERS fund, but it's somewhere in the range of about $750 million presently invested within Oregon's borders.
You mean of this fund or
all? No, of all funds. And so consequently, when we manage the principal trust funds, this being the third largest of those trust funds, PERS and SAFE coming first, we do treat them as a total and look toward investment opportunities within Oregon. Clearly, we as an investor prefer to invest in Oregon if the rate of return and the credit risk is equal to or better than what we could get elsewhere. We always prefer to invest in Oregon.
What kind of loans or things are you
I was going to ask about how much do we have invested
in Oregon out of the Common School Fund?
Yes.
The investments in the Common School Fund land right now are totally corporate bonds, and there just aren't any or very few Oregon corporations that are issuing corporate bonds. Consequently, the Common School Fund itself has no specific Oregon investments. It also, I should point out, over the last several years, at the direction of principally Secretary Paulus on the land board, there's been a desire to be able to shorten up the portfolio, and as a result, we've been investing in very short-term investments, which are not the kinds of investments we make in Oregon. I mean, if you look at our other PERS fund direct investments, we're making principally in single-family mortgages, commercial business loans, and other things which have longer maturities and therefore have not met the investment criteria of the Common School Fund. But if I may, even though we have none here in the Common School Fund, we approach, as I say, our investment opportunities in Oregon looking at all of the funds, and every time an investment comes up as a possibility, we have not yet hit the point which says, hold it, we have too much Oregon investment, we can't make it, could we make it only in the Common School Fund? We haven't hit that problem. There's always been sufficient room in any and all of the funds that have had their own investment criteria better suited to the type of investment we've made here in Oregon.
Senator McCoy.
If making the investments in exclusively from the fund in Oregon, would you in any way affect the commercial investment in the state, or is that, I don't know how much commercial investment we're getting from the banks and other institutions. Would it harm those investments in any way?
Madam Chair, Senator McCoy, we see ourselves in terms of an investor roughly as a private investor. That is, we expect the same type of terms and conditions to be any kind of investment, and we would be specifically asking for that same sort of terms and conditions. The only difference, I suppose, is that we really see ourselves, generally speaking, as a passive investor. We aren't out there making investment deals, putting them together. We really are having them as a brought to us. Insofar as we then add additional dollars for competition for investment opportunities within the state of Oregon, that will affect how other private investors act. At $116 million, which is the figure for the Common School Fund as of March 31st, that is not a relatively large amount for the state of Oregon.
And you've got $116 million in the Common School Fund, and there's how much totally invested in Oregon of the other funds, about, approximately?
Let's see. $805 million as of the figure that I have is as of December 31st, 1980. Two, that is not going to change much. That's about the figure right now today, too.
So the right $800 million in Oregon, and this would propose to say, you know, add all of the states, the common fund, but really what you could do is just transfer some of that other stuff. The question is land board direction of policies, in the sense that you couldn't get long-term corporate loans moved over into Oregon, or what would you invest in Oregon given the same policies? What could you invest in?
Madam Chair, if I understand the question correctly, what you're really saying is, would investing in the Common School Fund in Oregon make any difference in total of how we operate all of our trust funds? And the answer is no. We're running right now in the trust funds, and we really treat those, although there are distinctions among them, there are in terms of investment objectives, those are generally slight. It is more aimed at the accounting that's necessary, of course, for the various trust funds. As a result, in the trust funds themselves, we have about a little over $700 million invested in Oregon. If we are to make an Oregon investment, generally because of the sheer size, it goes into PERS. We make investments because they are good investments. If we put it into the Common School Fund, that wouldn't make more dollars available for other Oregon investments, because we are looking all the time and have capacity to make additional investments in Oregon. It would provide some kind of accounting that would say that instead of entering it under PERS or SAVAX Insurance Fund, we'd enter it under the Common School Fund.